we've been able to both be a moonshot company building technology that has a long horizon on realizing its full potential, but also create revenue, value, and frankly, cash along the way. Do I think VR devices are going to replace mobile phones or PCs or consoles as the primary way people interact in interactive entertainment? Not anytime soon. We have many ventures and subsidiaries that we've built in our larger play toward the metaverse, and realizing value from them is a really great way to build a sustainable business for us at Improbable.
From the first-time founders to the funds that back them, innovation needs different. Our episode partner, HSBC Innovation Banking, is proud to accelerate growth for tech and life science businesses, creating meaningful connections and opening up a world of opportunity for entrepreneurs and investors alike. Discover more at www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. Hello and welcome to the UKTN podcast, a weekly chat with the movers and shakers of the UK tech industry and the destination for all things UK tech related. I'm your host, Jane Wakefield, and this week I am joined by Herman Narula, the CEO of Improbable, a firm which makes software for virtual worlds and metaverse environments. Welcome, Herman.
Lovely to be here.
Now, the tagline of your company is about designing, building and operating metaverse experiences. So let's start by you just sort of painting a picture for us of some of the things that you have built and done so far.
Sure. So over the last few months, and in fact, the last year, we've run in excess, I think, of like 30 to 40 large scale experiences with, you know, in some cases, thousands of users coming into events. And these range from sporting events. So we did the first broadcast of a baseball match into the metaverse with about 12,000 people attending, I believe, something in that region. Not only all being able to talk to each other, socialize from across the world and the US, singing songs, hanging out, but also actually broadcast the movements of the players into that virtual world. We've run game experiences with major influencers who've appeared into the world and being able to have them actually talk in real time to all of their fans. We've done album launch parties, for example, for the band Twice, a major K-pop act that were able to bring all of their fans into a single space where everyone could dance and sing and hang out together. And we've also created a number of experiences that have actually been more for communities to meet up. So indeed, our own company is actually all of our employees around the world sort of meet up every week inside the metaverse in a mass group of people, which is a lot better than Zoom because everyone can see everyone and interact with everyone in ways that aren't otherwise possible. And we see continued demand in everything from sport to traditional games to music and actually even just in general now, even smaller groups and teams that want to bring their communities together.
Now, two of the things that were most important to you were gaming and defense, but last year you sold those divisions. What was the reason behind that? Why did you get out of those two particular areas?
We didn't get out of gaming. So when I talk about the metaverse, I am talking about games and gaming, and many of the use cases and applications are video games or video game-like experiences. We sold our defense business and we sold one of our ventures, which was a headcount-based services arm in gaming that I think we sold for about $100 million, having acquired it a few years earlier for a lot less. We exited defense, both defense and that, as a venture builder when we reach points of maturation on specific ventures. We then look for opportunities to monetize and realize value in them. And that's basically just an ordinary course of business thing. On the defense side, we have been doubling down heavily on the metaverse. And I guess on some level, it does make sense for us to have that focus. But ultimately, both of these were just really good commercial deals. And we anticipate doing more of them in the future. We have many ventures and subsidiaries that we've built in our larger play toward the metaverse. And realizing value from them is a really great way to build a sustainable business for us at Improbable. It's meant that we're not reliant on venture capital. We haven't needed to do a funding round, and we have many, many years of runway now.
And so talking about funding, I mean, you had some very big investors and a very high valuation. So does that mean you don't plan to raise again?
It's not necessary for Improbable to raise money at the moment. And I think when our financials come out this year, I don't want to preempt them, but they'll be even better progress than we had the year before. And I think we're now very much a sustainable or close to sustainable, depending on how you want to count the numbers, business, even at our scale, which is very unusual for tech companies that have achieved unicorn valuations during the boom time. Many of them haven't lived up to those expectations with high revenue numbers. They haven't generated real cash. They haven't realized value from anything. And I think Improbable is unusual in that we've been able to both be a moonshot company building technology that has a long horizon on realizing its full potential, but also create revenue, value, and frankly, cash along the way. And it's meant that we've been able to be very independent. Does that mean we wouldn't raise money? Well, we actually have raised money into individual ventures that where we've partnered with investors. For example, we recently announced our football metaverse project with partners like Alex Inchenko and Kanu, had actually raised capital from Local Globe, who are one of the early investors in Improbable. But having the freedom and flexibility to bring in capital to individual projects where we see fit, or potentially into the Topco if we felt as though that was something where we'd be able to command a really good price, is a great thing. But there's a big difference between being able to do that and having to do that. And the great thing about Improbable right now is we don't have to do that. And we have the freedom to really look long, long term at our business.
Now, you've listed a lot of things that you've done, some of which you've sold off, some of which you're still involved in. So what would you sort of say was your business's core focus?
So we build the technology to enable all of the experiences I've described. And that technology is monetized in two ways. One, through specific ventures, which are metaverses, partnerships in the industries that I've described. Those generate all the events that we've talked about. And the other is through the M Squared network, which is kind of like a decentralized collaborative network where all of these businesses can interact with each other. And I think maybe this is why it's a little unusual talking about trying to describe Improbable in terms of a regular non-decentralized, non-Web3 business, because building platforms that have these properties is a really new thing. And one of the great things about it is each individual business on top can actually be quite valuable, but the underlying network can also create value directly. When we've shown how that can work in the round into M Squared that we did in the last 2 years, which allowed us to sort of bring investors directly into that network.
Now, the metaverse is a bit of a concept that a lot of people don't entirely understand, which makes things even more complicated for you guys as well, I guess. And also, isn't it the case that it's a little bit of a failed concept? A few years ago, I remember writing about the metaverse and talking to people who'd invested in metaverse worlds like Decentraland, made lots of money in property. Every brand wanted a presence in the metaverse. And of course, a company known as Facebook changed its name to Meta, really putting its money behind the idea. And yet even Mark Zuckerberg is now saying that actually their investment in the future, at least in this year, is going to be in AI rather than the metaverse. So isn't the metaverse over before it's begun?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting perspective. I would just look at the numbers. And for me, I would say Europe has 746 million people in it. And right now, there are 300 million monthly active users that are inside metaverse experiences in which people are working, earning an income, hanging out with celebrities, engaging in large-scale brands. In many ways, what Improbable is doing is taking that medium forward by enabling thousands of people to interact in a single world or enabling new business models. But we're really working in a highly established industry. I wrote a book on this 2 years ago called Virtual Society. But if you're under the age of sort of 20 now, and someone like a journalist were to walk up to you and say the metaverse isn't real, I mean, you just think they were daft. It'd be like saying football isn't real. And I think this is a disconnect between the people who write about video games and the metaverse outside of the industry and the people that are in it. It is the case that certain projects that were very high profile, for example, Sandbox and Decentraland, which were trying to use sort of crypto and the metaverse together, maybe didn't realize the kind of value that people thought they would. But to label, to kind of imagine that suddenly Roblox stopped existing, which is, you know, I think a $30, $40 billion public company, or Minecraft stopped existing, you know, or any of these things didn't exist, it is kind of a bit laughable for the people that work within this space. And it's really confusing being in an industry in which every now and then someone will write an article that it's dead, but it's making, you know, billions and billions of dollars a year in cash. So I think that is a misconception that needs to get cleared up in the way we communicate about the metaverse.
And you're right, absolutely. Gaming seems, to me at least, to be the likeliest home for virtual reality and metaverse technology. I guess the question then is, how do you move it beyond gaming? You've spoken about how you see people developing life skills in virtual worlds. But isn't it the case that actually people, young people, are going to these worlds simply to play a game and not to sort of have other life experiences there?
No, there are in fact people having those life experiences now. I mean, a great example would be 15, 20 years ago when Robert Whitehead, my co-founder, went into Second Life. He learned to program in Second Life, and he actually earned enough income to pay for his Cambridge education. And that was 20 years ago. That was before all of the technology and development happening now. So once again, I think, you know, the average age of a gamer is 34. it is a little bit of a cultural bifurcation. You know, it's the same for me. When I see some of the things people are doing on TikTok, I find it really confusing. You know, it's not of my generation. But my generation, you know, I learned life skills in video games. I interacted with, you know, people around the world. I learned to build businesses and engage with things with platforms like this. And so really, we're talking about the next generation of metaverse experiences. But once again, it's very strange that, you know, we're not discussing here speculative activity. There are literally millions of people today who earn an income inside metaverse experiences. And that income is an important part of their day-to-day existence. So I do think we're talking about expanding something that's already real. Even if you were to look at VR and say, okay, maybe VR didn't have the uptake that we thought it would. Well, there are 30 million VR headsets right now that are installed and active, and it's growing. So this is one of those areas where I think the data doesn't lie.
HSBC Innovation Banking, our partner for this episode, provides commercial banking services, expertise, and insights to the technology, life science and healthcare, private equity, and venture capital industries. To find out why innovation needs different, go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. You mentioned headsets, so let's talk about the hardware for a minute, because it has to date been considered quite clunky. What are your thoughts on Apple's Vision Pro, which, whilst probably improving the hardware dramatically, is still very expensive, isn't it, for the average consumer?
Definitely. And I think the Apple Vision Pro is an attempt to build a premium device focused on productivity rather than interactive experiences at the moment. There aren't many games or other ways to play on it, although that will change with time. I actually think, you know, and I've previously been something of a critic of Facebook due to the influence I thought they would bring to, you know, gaming in the metaverse. I have to compliment, though, the Oculus 3. Until that device came out, I myself was something of a VR skeptic. But now I would say I primarily game in that device, you know, which is not something I thought I'd be saying. But you see even small improvements in the ability to not have motion sickness or nausea, improved visuals, better audio, make it a really powerful device. So do I think VR devices are going to replace mobile phones or PCs or consoles as the primary way people interact in interactive entertainment? Not anytime soon, which is why Improbable is device agnostic. You know, all of the experiences I'm describing, bringing thousands of people to baseball matches or music events, we've focused on phones and PC and console, less console, more sort of PC and phone. But I do think it's a growing market and segment. And I think it's clear that there are benefits to a subset of people for using those devices. It's very immersive. It's a great way of having social experiences. So I suspect it's only going to grow. And the Oculus 3's price point, I think, is a tenth or something of the Apple's. So and then that's before we consider, you know, potentially Chinese manufacturers or others coming up with even lower priced devices that will borrow from this technology.
Now, presumably, when you have your staff meetings in virtual reality, you don't expect everybody to own and wear one of these headsets. So talk me through how that works, how the experience works when you're not actually putting yourself inside a virtual world via a headset.
One of the massive problems we've solved as Improbable, which has driven all the demand for our services, is that without our technology, you can really only have a small number of people in a rich virtual environment. And you tend to have to make a compromise. Either you can have more people, but then make the environment very simple, or you can have a fewer people and make it more complex. So we enable up to 30,000 people to spend time together in a rich virtual environment where they can all speak, see each other, be rendered on screen. And one of the things we've done is actually make it very efficient to send down the bandwidth to support that, even if you're on a lower quality internet connection. And you can also access the world even if you're using a mobile phone or a Mac or a PC. Indeed, we even have an access mode where you just use it through a browser. So when we do our staff meetings, we have a lot of people who, you know, hundreds of people who maybe don't have gaming hardware. They can just access it via the browser, which makes it really convenient to enter these worlds.
And what difference has it made to the decisions that you make at these meetings? Because ultimately, this tech, it is only going to be of use if it's making that experience better by improving the outcome of these things. You know, everybody hates boring meetings. So has this transformed the nature of meetings and therefore the nature of what you decide? Or
yeah, I mean, I guess one of the biggest things is when even if you're having a conversation like a Zoom talk with people, the fact that everyone can react is enormously valuable. And not just react in a kind of like raise your hand in Zoom way, but you can like literally see hundreds of people clustering, interacting. You can hear their voices. When you make a joke and people don't laugh, it's really funny. When people do laugh, it's even better and even more valuable. Also, the environments are so much more than communication spaces. You know, you can have rich interactions there. When we talk about our technology and do show and tells, people can actually spawn and create objects in the world live. Rob was showing us on Friday how to use a specific new type of programming interface we'd created for making interoperable objects. And while he was having the discussion, he could actually create the objects in the world and show people the code on screens that everybody could watch. We had a customer join us in the presentation with hundreds of our staff, all of whom could kind of applaud and talk to the customer who can talk back to them and ask them questions. We were able to create microphones in the ground to sort of have people interact. That is a level of meaningful social cohesion that when you're a remote business, which frankly, many companies now are, especially in technology, there really are very few ways to have. And it doesn't just apply to sort of business. I mentioned to you, for example, the album launch parties. In that context, you had loads of fans of something who typically would only be able to communicate through text chat, who could now have, you know, a much more dynamic interaction with each other. And we know from psychology how important this type of rich fulfillment is to keep people engaged.
So do people have to appear as avatars? I know that Mark Zuckerberg was also a big fan of the idea of meetings in virtual spaces, but Horizon World, the Meta virtual reality world, came in for a lot of criticism. Initially, the avatars didn't even have legs and it was all just a little bit basic. So how does it work visually?
You know, we provide a technology that really allows quite a lot of flexibility in the answer to that question. You know, you can build very photorealistic avatars, or you can appear as a potato if you wish, as someone has done at one point in one of our meetings. You know, you can kind of look and feel and create the presence of yourself that's most appropriate for the interaction you're engaged in. And I think one of the things that has perhaps obscured the conversation is the freedom to appear as what you wish can be very valuable in sort of fun and social interactions. It doesn't mean that you have to appear as something wacky or strange or different. You could appear merely as yourself. For example, we have a technology that can render on screen very different models in very large crowds. And so in one of our services, you just take three pictures of yourself with the webcam that you have. We use an external provider to generate an avatar that looks just like you, and you're there. We did a meet and greet with Alex Zinchenko from Arsenal, where hundreds of people showed up, and he was there, and he looked like himself, and he was just himself, and I was myself. And we were able to interact in a way that wouldn't have been possible otherwise.
What was the thinking behind the potato?
One of our engineers really, really wanted to be a potato. I mean, I think you'd have to ask him as to why he was a potato, but it is what it is.
Excellent. Now, you've also written about how the virtual world is sort of the next big wilderness. Is that partly because it's not regulated and this brings its own issues, doesn't it? The lack of regulation in these spaces, especially if, as you predict, we're going to have hundreds, thousands of people operating in them. This is going to be a moderation nightmare, isn't it?
Well, there are actually quite a lot of regulations and moderation tools today. So, you know, the ability to prevent antisocial behavior in games is in the interest of games companies and has been for over 20 years. So people already, and we have, frankly, moderation services to prevent people from, you know, hurling abuse at one another, all sorts of things inside public social experiences. Some of that's automated. Some of that involves actual people. When you have very large crowds, we find the behavior is really different. So when you have thousands of people together, strangely, they seem to behave better than when you have small groups of people. And I think partly why, from all of our surveying and doing, I mean, we're the only company that can actually do these crowds. So it's been really interesting to gather this data as kind of the pioneers in this space. But what we found really, really surprisingly is people seem to react with the same feeling of social pressure as they would get in the real world. They want to follow instructions. They want to go along with the occasion and the event, especially if there's a celebrity present or someone else present. I think people just feel like everyone can watch them and hear them and it's being broadcast. So there's a bit of social pressure. That doesn't mean you don't get the odd antisocial person, but drastically less than you would expect. In terms of regulation, well, of course, you know, if you're dealing with something online involving young people, there's tons of regulation around that. Data, there's tons of regulation around that, especially in the context of being in the EU with GDPR and other things. There's a ton of incentives to ensure that people ultimately are producing good experiences. It's quite different from social media. In social media, all anyone cares about is content and engagement, right? And that means that even really negative and poisonous content can actually end up rewarded within social media. Games aren't really like that. I'll give you a great example. If you're playing a game, even not a metaverse experience, but something like Call of Duty, say, or Halo, and you know someone hurls abuse at you and you stop playing as a result of that, that's against the interests of the games company. They kind of go out of their way to ensure that, you know, at the best that they can, they try to prevent that from occurring because they care about your long-term engagement with the experience. It's also very important to appreciate that these are not talk spaces. These are actually goal-driven environments. People are trying to accomplish something, experience something. And for that reason, the way they relate to one another is quite different than in a chat room. You know, on Reddit or on Twitter, there's no cost to just hurling abuse at one another. But if we're all, you know, for example, trying to build something together and someone's being kind of an asshole in the corner, they're getting in the way of that activity. And that creates a very different social dynamic.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you have in the past been a critic of Facebook, and you're a passionate believer in the fact that we shouldn't sort of replicate the eras of the internet where a few big tech firms dominated the space in this new era of virtual reality. But how do we avoid it?
Crypto and decentralization. You know, if you really have two choices. The reason centralization emerges is not due to evil intent from the parts of companies. Niall Ferguson, actually, the historian, talks beautifully about this. I believe he talks about this quite a lot in his book, which I referenced in mine. And he describes effectively how, even since the printing press, building networks tends to create centralization because the cost of engaging with a service goes down when you have, you know, a central thing. It's why we get districts and cities, right, where things tend to cluster together because it's more convenient. That tends to create a lot of power. What Web3 and blockchain and cryptocurrencies enable, and yes, I'm aware of a lot of criticisms around them, but what they enable is really a different economic model, one where everyone can share in the value of a service and not one person has to run it. So for Improbable with M Squared, we're building a metaverse network. So all this technology that I'm describing, it isn't something that we gatekeep in the same way as we would if we were building a traditional project like Roblox or Fortnite. We're actually letting all of our partners co-own this experience, take part in that decision-making and moderation and contribution of value. It means they can all build much more valuable businesses, but it also means that we can tackle problems together that perhaps we couldn't tackle alone as an individual business.
So let's talk a little bit about M Squared then, because it seems like this is going to be a really important part of what you offer in future. So where is it now? What is it doing now? And where do you see it going in the sort of
all of the
future?
Partners and experiences that we're describing, from football to baseball to music to Web3, with some of the largest communities in that space, such as Bored Apes and others. All of those things are currently powered by M Squared. They're all rooted together on the same network. So we've learned quite a lot, you know, as a business that has generated multiple successive generations of technology. And what we've done is ensured that before we sort of make M Squared generally available, we have a lot of partners who are really using it in anger and improving the technology and kind of developing public experiences. So it really is three things. It's a way of keeping track of people, places, and things in the metaverse without them being bound to any one business or service. That's really valuable because all of these businesses want to relate to each other's content. I want to take my baseball hat from my baseball metaverse and move it into a different world. How do I do that? That's a critical function that it provides. The other thing that it provides is the technology to actually enable these experiences to be easily built. It's incredibly expensive and complicated to make online worlds. We've commodified that. And M Squared is essentially a decentralized metaverse platform that makes it really easy to build these services.
So what do you think the future holds now that AI is taking over a lot of their headlines, at least, and a lot of companies are doubling down and refocusing their efforts on AI? What role does that play in the development of virtual worlds?
I think it supercharges it, right? The inclusion of AI reduces the cost of content, which is the main barrier of building experimental businesses in this space. We've already reduced the cost of content from millions of dollars to thousands, to hundreds of thousands at worst, to make, you know, these types of virtual worlds, which is a huge reduction. If you now introduce AI, which we've been using for years to power the 20 billion messages a second that our network needs to handle, or to support the rendering or other pieces, that technology actually can make it even cheaper, even easier, even quicker to build content. It can also enable wholly new experiences. You know, if the characters you're interacting with in the metaverse have brains that are as interesting as GPT, then suddenly the experiences you can have are a lot more interesting. You know, perhaps you can talk to a character that would teach you the rules of the sport that you're engaged with, or could even bring together your group and create fun for them, or even host an experience, or even modify that experience in real time. In order to support that, we've developed a few things. One of them is a language called Metaverse Markup Language. And this is very AI friendly. It's designed to be used programmatically, so you can change the world on the fly or create objects that you can define in ways that AI are very good at doing, using languages that they're good at. And all of this is really just going to catalyze it further. I think it also creates new problems. For example, does an AI have a bank account? I mean, probably not. If you've ever tried to open a bank account, I mean, it's hard enough in Britain, but try doing it in India or anywhere else. You need like 19 passport photos and all manner of things. I think we're quite a way away from giving AI bank accounts. So how will AI use money? Well, probably cryptocurrencies, which are much easier for them to use and to interact with. You also mentioned something very interesting, which was now that AI has dominated the headlines. And I think this speaks to your earlier question about, oh, is the metaverse dead? Is it alive? We're living in a world where something can have 300 million users and be argued to be dead by the press. I wonder if what the headlines are focusing on is necessarily what people are really using or what's really important. So I'd caution anyone listening to sort of use the headlines as a barometer of what is or is not being used. You know, it's clear that there's a little bit of disconnect there.
So you're obviously very optimistic about the future of virtual reality and obviously improbable. So let's just talk finally about how you see the future playing out for you as a company in the next few years.
Well, I mean, we've crossed some pretty significant revenue milestones, as our financials will show, and we're now a sustainable business in terms of cash, which is exciting and means that we have a pretty promising future just at a pure business level. But I think at a technology and product level, it feels as though perhaps we were quite early when we developed Spatial OS, and adoption at that time for these types of technologies was lower. We've seen a huge inflection of adoption and growth in the last 2 years. In many ways, the last 2 years have sort of dominated the previous eight, both commercially and in terms of technology and in terms of the ease of adoption. So I actually think we're almost just now getting started, which is a strange thing to say for a company at these revenue levels, but it almost feels like we're at exactly the right time to be doing the things that we set out to do, perhaps just graduating college. Now, it feels like the world is sort of almost ready for these technologies.
Well, it's certainly been fascinating talking through them with you, Herman Narula. Thank you for joining me. But that's all we've got time for on this episode of the UKTM podcast. We will be back next week with another one. In the meantime, you can keep up to date with all the latest UK tech developments at www.uktech.news. Don't forget to follow UKTN on LinkedIn and X, where you can also get in touch with me with your comments and suggestions about the show. Until next time, it's goodbye from me. This podcast is brought to you by HSBC Innovation Banking, the power behind the UK's forward thinkers, future makers, and leap takers. They're helping to ignite the bold ideas that reshape our world. Go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb to find out how innovation needs different. We'll be right back.